SEC Sports Pro Basketball Talk Podcast. Brett Polakoff here with Kurt Heelan. What is going on, Kurt?
I'm pumped up for 2013. I'm going with that. I'm pumped up for 2013.
Is that the resolution officially?
Yeah, that and to lose weight, to eat better, and like all the usual ones. Except drink less alcohol. I'm not doing that one.
No, you have to drink more alcohol, I think, is the way to go.
I don't know if I'm going
to
do that.
Yeah, I just felt like an idiot on New Year's Day at the gym, you know, basically like everybody else.
Yeah, it's the tough part of the year to go to the gym because you're like, man, where did all these people come from?
Yeah, and if you have a regular membership, like if you go all the time like I do, January, February is terrible because all of a sudden it's insanely crowded and you want to just yell at these people like, just go away. You're not going to stick with it anyway. So just give me my gym back for these first 2 months while you're figuring it out.
Exactly.
All right, well, let's get into it here. We had last night's game. No TNT action thanks to some college bowl games, but we had a pretty good matchup in the San Antonio Spurs visiting the New York Knicks. Knicks got the win 100-83. For the Spurs, it was their fourth game in 5 nights, so we all kind of wondered if Greg Popovich was going to pull another stunt and maybe rest some of his players. Didn't do that, but he did get to sit him early thanks to the margin of victory that the Knicks were up by sort of towards the end of that game. Want to get your thoughts on this game. Do you think it was the Spurs being tired during that stretch of 4 and 5 nights, or did the Knicks just have what it takes, and did they just really put it to San Antonio?
I mean, I think a lot of it was frankly the Spurs, and I think, you know, this makes Popovich's point about why he rested those guys before, and granted, he certainly did 3 guys on national television to snub the nose of the NBA a little bit, but his point is valid. Like, if you're going to play an older team 4 games in 5 nights, and especially if they've got some games coming up that matter in conference, that's the kind of game you might rest guys, and he didn't do it this time. They looked terrible. But that said, I think the Knicks deserve some credit. They looked a lot better than they have recently, and I think Prigioni's a large part of that. I mean, they miss Felton at the point. They've been having issues before, and they found a guy who, for a night at least, looked really good.
Yeah, and I agree with the, you know, 4 games in 5 nights thing because, you know, this was a 2-point game at halftime, so obviously fatigue caught up with them in the second half. But I do want to give the Knicks some credit. They started Marcus Camby on the front line alongside Tyson Chandler, and it forced San Antonio into an uncomfortable amount of long-distance shots, which, you know, they made very few of. 34 of the Spurs' 77 field goal attempts were 3-pointers last night. And the Spurs rank, they're about 6th in the league with a little over 22 three-point attempts per game. They finished with 34 last night, and they had 18 by halftime. So in the first half, while the game was still, you know, a contest, again, it was only 2 points at the half, the Knicks' defense inside forced San Antonio into doing what they didn't want to do. That's one of the things I like the most about this Knicks team is that they do seem to have pieces that can match up with a lot of different styles of play.
Yeah, I agree. And clearly they've built this team a little bit to be able to go smaller with Tyson Chandler and Carmelo at the four. And that's clearly to match up with the Heat. But you're right. They were able to go big and do this. They've got veteran guys who can, you know, step in and play different roles. And, you know, you've got Prigioni, you've got Camby, you've got Rasheed Wallace when he's healthy. Guys who can do different things for them and really help on both ends of the floor. You know, we'll get into this in a few minutes when we talk with Howard Beck of the New York Times. We talk a little Knicks and a lot of Nets with him, and I spoke with him yesterday. But his interesting point was that this is going to be one of the challenges for the Knicks. You know, they've got that older bench. They're going to start relying on it more and more now as they get into the middle of the season and guys get banged up or guys just get tired. And that's where we're going to see if that older bench can wears down a little during the season.
Well, one of the things that DJ Foster brought up in his recap for the site last night was the Knicks' defensive efficiency rating. I think they're around 20th right now on the season, and he pointed out, like, teams pretty much don't make the finals unless they're right around in the top 10 at a bare minimum, 10th, 11th. Knicks are all the way down at 20th. I don't know. I mean, I like their defense last night. Could have been the tired Spurs team, could have been the matchup, but do you think their defense will be a problem for them, you know, once we get into the postseason?
I think their defense gets better for two reasons. A, they get Shumpert back, which will help on the perimeter greatly. You know, I think we forget how good, really good a defender he is and what he gives them. And I think, you know, look, they've got Tyson Chandler, they've got Marcus Camby, who for all his flaws is still a really good rim protector. I think that their defense will come around and be a lot better by the end of the season. I'm not sure if it's championship good, but I think that part of the floor will get a lot better for them.
Well, you mentioned Shumpert. I mean, I think we have to expect him to be at least much slower than the last time we saw him. You know, just given, you know, the amount of hair the guy has on his head at this point. I mean, it's kind of ridiculous. I don't know if you've gotten a look at that in person yet, but I saw it on Christmas Day, and it was it's real and it's spectacular. We'll just put it that way.
He's certainly going to be slowed by the hair and the knee and everything else, but he's still long and a better defender than Jason Kidd is, who's, at age 90 isn't that hard to dribble around anymore. So,
all right, and then just the last thing on these two teams, you know, the Spurs talk more than anybody else about sort of being an aging team, and, you know, because of Popovich's propensity to rest guys, you know, he always talks about 4 and 5 nights and we're tired. But, you know, if you look at their roster, they're really not an old team once you get beyond, like, Duncan. You know, he's the aging guy that you have to worry about. He only played 24 minutes last night. And, you know, their biggest guys are, you know, Kawhi Leonard's a starter, Danny Green's a starter. They're not old players. And I don't know. It just seems to me like Popovich makes this more of a bigger deal than it needs to be when every single team in the league goes through the exact same thing.
The Spurs have done a really good job, and they've done this for years, of keeping their role players younger and more athletic to try to make up for the lack of athleticism you really get with Duncan. And I don't mean that as a detriment to his overall game. I mean, he's one of the great fours ever, but he's not like Griffin. He's never been the explosive athlete. And they've always gotten around that by having really more athletic, younger guys on the wing. And I think you're right. It's the core that's older, but those are the guys you've got to rest, and the team's – I would say the team's not quite the same if you don't play them, but then again, you sit all three of the big stars and they almost beat the Heat anyway.
Yeah, there's definitely, I mean, they're a talented team. They're deep. I don't think it's going to be an issue. It's just, I don't know, to me it's just interesting how much focus there is on the Spurs being on an old team, and they're not that old, and then Popovich rest guys, and I don't know, it just seems like a lot of teams in the league have to go through the same thing, so. All right, well, let's switch gears here. We had the latest returns for the All-Star voting come down. Kobe Bryant still leading all voters over LeBron James. You know, we still had a couple guys, though, that look like basically locks to end up in the starting lineup. A couple of them are Dwight Howard, Kevin Garnett, who, you know, both legitimate superstars from a career standpoint, but neither one of them is really playing at an all-star level this season. Charles Barkley had something to say about that this week. What did you think about his comments?
Yeah, it's Barkley being Barkley. I mean,
yeah.
I guess it really comes down to what you expect out of the All-Star game and why you're voting people in. I mean, to me, it's an exhibition, so I don't have a problem really with, Howard's a lock. Garnett, you know, I'm forgetting the number off the top of my head, but I think Chris Bosh is within 50,000 of him, so I suppose it is votes. It is conceivable that he could get caught, but it's not likely. I mean, really, in general, there's almost never any change from the original voting in the All-Star game. Like, the first time they release the votes and you see who the starters are, there's almost never, you know, a change in how that goes down. I don't have a huge problem with it, like I said, because it's an exhibition and I just kind of accept it that way. As long as the guy isn't a complete mess or hasn't played, you know, the years Yao Ming was voted a starter were pretty annoying. But beyond that, it doesn't bother me that much.
So you're not in favor of Andrew Bynum's 93,000 votes?
No. Yeah, Andrew Bynum and, you know, Jeremy Lin's almost in there in the West. He's right behind Chris Paul, and I think that would be but Chris Paul's an MVP candidate who's been playing at that level for years, and Jeremy Lin is not. I mean, Jeremy Lin's had some nice seasons. He's actually, I think, had some good games, and he's getting better and figuring it out. But he is not Chris Paul and shouldn't be anywhere close to it.
Yeah, you mentioned the gap. I'm looking at the numbers here. So Chris Bosh is about 28,000 votes behind Kevin Garnett. And that's, you know, that's a margin that he could make up, you know, down the stretch. Especially, I think more people vote in the close races as we get closer to the All-Star game. So there's that. And then, yeah, Jeremy Lin, we're looking at 46,000 votes behind Chris Paul. I think the way the Clippers are going and the fact that Chris Paul plays in Los Angeles is going to, you know, keep him in the starting lineup. But here's a question for you. You know, this isn't exactly the presidential election, right? Like, who cares ultimately who's in the All-Star game? So if you're the NBA, why not just announce, yeah, Chris Paul won? Like, let's say Jeremy Lin did get voted in. Let's say somehow there's a massive surge and he beat Chris Paul by 100,000 votes. Why not just rig it and just say, you know what? Chris Paul's in. Sorry, you know, that's the way it happened. There's not going to be any investigation or, you know, cry out from the fans across the globe, is there?
No, probably not. I mean, it's the American Idol thing. I think more people probably vote for NBA All-Stars than they do in the presidential election. At least it feels that way. I guess they could. I mean, I've seen the results come out of the league office. I've never, you know, especially since the league office gets its votes. I mean, you can vote on Twitter this year by just using a hashtag. You can you've been able to vote online for a long time. You can vote with hanging chads there and those old style ballots at the games.
Exactly.
I suppose you could pretty easily rig that kind of thing if you wanted to. I'm not sure that they're doing that because, you know, David Stern is a man of integrity and honesty and would never rig such a thing.
But, he wouldn't do it for the NBA draft, so why would he do it for something like this?
Exactly. But I suppose you could.
But it's not even rigging it. Like, they don't even have to do anything funny. All they have to do is just announce different numbers.
Exactly. Yeah, that's true. They would just suddenly, like, there would be a red line through some of this stuff. Like, those weren't the real numbers. And then, exactly, if Chris Paul starts over Jeremy Lin and it was found out to be rigged, would anybody really be that mad? Or would it just be like, well, that's what should have happened?
Yeah, the league can pretty much do what it wants. But, you know, back on the topic of, you know, guys like Dwight Howard, Kevin Garnett, I'm with you. I don't really have a problem with it. And the reason I don't is because these guys are superstars. They are kind of the faces of the game. They've been around the league a long time. So even if this season they're not having a great year, if the fans want to see them in there, I think it's good for the league to have familiar faces like that. You know, even if the hardcore fans know for a fact, hey, this guy isn't really living up to it this year. And, you know, the coaches can pick whoever they want as the reserves. And there's almost never a huge travesty of people being left off because of too many, you know, non-deserving people getting voted into the starting lineup.
Exactly. I mean, usually the people who are voted in, like you said, are the kind of superstars of the game. And then if there's guys who have had fantastic first half of the years, guys around the border, you know, the coaches kind of take care of that. And we can argue around the edges whether, you know, who should be the fifth guard in the West or something, but Stephen Curry. But but whoever, you know, it's not a disaster. It's not the problem is there's really, once you get to those last few spots, there's probably 7 to 10 guys who are deserving and 2 or 3 guys who get them. And that's just, you know, that's kind of how it is.
Now we welcome into the podcast, and we're really lucky to have him here with us today, Howard Beck of the New York Times. He covers the Brooklyn Nets, the Knicks, really the entire NBA for the publication. And thanks for coming in and taking the time to be with us.
Yeah, my pleasure, Kurt.
Look, you've been one of the first people reporting and kind of on top of it when we're talking about the Nets and their next coach, that option number one is Phil Jackson, and then option number two is pretty much Phil Jackson. Is that what you're hearing still?
Yeah, he might be option number three, too. You know, it's interesting right now. The sense I've been getting, and I'm writing about this again as we speak, is that the Nets know exactly what they want to do. They want to see if Phil Jackson is interested. And if he is interested, they want to have a really nice conversation and, you know, throw around dollar signs and visions of what else they can do with the roster and some means of giving him a path to another championship, which would be his 12th as coach. And that's the conversation they want to have. We don't know yet whether it's a conversation that Phil Jackson wants to have. Yeah, everybody's got, you know, not everybody, but there are, you know, various reports out there that he's either intrigued, interested, curious, something along those lines. But, you know, no definitive word. And the one statement his agent released to David Aldridge of TNT last week was he's not interested at this time, which, you know, looked very clearly like an intentional hedge. So where does that leave us? It leaves us with TJ Carlesimo doing a pretty decent job so far, going 3-1 and with a huge, huge win in Oklahoma City. And, you know, I think we need to start taking a little bit more seriously the statements we've heard so far from Mikhail Prokhorov, the owner, and Billy King, the GM. They both said TJ is the coach. And I think we all just kind of thought, well, that's the diplomatic answer. And we all know better. But the more time that has gone by, it's only been a week, but the more time has gone by and the more I've heard that, and the more I've heard other things just kind of, you know, quietly off the record, it certainly sounds like that's exactly their agenda. Carlesimo is obviously more than capable of steering this ship for now, possibly for the rest of the season. And, you know, you may get a better feel for what Phil Jackson's interest is in a few months than you might get now. Because, frankly, you know, Phil Jackson coming in the middle of the season may not make much sense. The triangle offense is, you know, complex, takes some time. He's never taken over a team midseason like this. So, you know, there's a lot of logic to kind of waiting this out. And then all that said, is there anybody else after that? As of right now, I'd say no. It's you know, PJ Carlesimo for the time being. It's attempts to get Phil Jackson eventually. And if Phil Jackson doesn't work out, and if you do decide to move on from PJ Carlesimo, then you start looking at other candidates. But that may be a discussion for, you know, May.
When you're talking about even potentially other candidates or Phil Jackson's interest, I mean, to me, part of the issue seems to be this roster and how far you can take this team as it currently stands and how much maneuverability you really have with the roster. I mean, it's not that great a roster. I'm not sure you're competing with the Heat and maybe even the Knicks, if you're going to call them the other elite team in the East, with this roster. Can you tweak it, or are you kind of stuck with this, and are the expectations too high for what they have in-house?
Great question, and it's probably the only relevant question, because as I quoted someone saying last week when this all first started to unfold, what Phil wants, according to people close to him, is a path to the championship. And, you know, I think we can all agree that, yeah, the Nets are not built to win a championship right now, this season. They have three really good pieces with Deron Williams, Joe Johnson, and Brooke Lopez, but they don't have that transcendent player like Kobe Bryant or Shaquille O'Neal or Michael Jordan or Scottie Pippen or LeBron James or Kevin Durant. I mean, they've got three really good players and some nice supporting cast guys, but, you know, it looks like a classic, you know, high 40s to maybe 50-win team if all breaks right. It's hard to envision them as a true title contender, and they don't have a lot of maneuverability, but they do have, you know, all of their draft picks to use. They have an intriguing young piece with Marshawn Brooks. They have Chris Humphrey's contract, which is an expiring contract after this season. It becomes an expiring at $12 million. So can you pick up somebody else's long-term contract that they're trying to dump? And is that piece enough to get them over the top? I don't know. And, you know, those are questions I imagine Phil Jackson is asking himself and you know, folks that would be on his staff. But I will say this. The roster, in terms of whether it fits what Phil Jackson does, I think is a good fit. And I've had conversations with people who know the triangle offense pretty well. And Brooke Lopez clearly is a great fit, you know, really versatile inside presence. You know, the triangle is you know, an inside-out offense, and so having that nice post presence is great. Deron Williams and Joe Johnson would both fit pretty well in it. You know, they're going to need other changes, but the basics of what they have would fit. And, you know, again, that doesn't necessarily mean they're title contenders. They're not. But that's one more reason why maybe that's a conversation you have with him after the season, because who knows what the Nets might pull off at this trade deadline or after the season. And maybe, you know, maybe that next upgrade is the one that makes it intriguing enough.
In the short term, like you mentioned before, PJ Carlesimo is not only 3-1, he got the quality win at Oklahoma City. Is that kind of a turning point for this team? And Deron Williams had a couple of good games in here of late. Is he starting to find his stride now?
You know, it looks like the classic turning point game, but it's so hard to read this team after, you know, the 11-4 November and the just crashing in December. None of us saw that coming last night. I mean, we're sitting there courtside just kind of, you know, looking at each other blankly, like, is this really happening? And I don't think anybody actually believed it was going to hold up. And sure enough, the 23-point first half lead was eventually entirely erased, but that only set up the even more impressive second stage, which was tied at 85 with 7 minutes to go. The Nets finish on, I think, a 23-8 kick, which, as I say, I think it was as impressive or more so than them getting the 23-point lead in the first half. It looked for real. It looked like the team we saw in November, the team that, you know, beat the Clippers and beat the Celtics twice and beat the Knicks once and took them out to overtime another time. I mean, when they're clicking on all cylinders, when the ball is moving, when they're, you know, being, you know, coordinated on defense, they've got the ability to be a really, really good team. So, you know, does that become a turning point? Do they learn their lesson and say, okay, that's the model and we've got to keep doing it and we got to stick to certain principles? You hope so. And I know that Carlesimo, you know, as we all know, he's got a reputation as a pretty fiery guy. We're seeing that guy emerge again as he's gotten kind of comfortable as the interim coach. And I've certainly heard that in practice he's been getting into guys pretty good. So we'll see. I thought this was going to be a top four team in the East when the season started. I still think they have that potential. That's not overstating how good they are. That's a recognition of the fact they do have some decent talent and we're underachieving, but it's also recognition of the fact that the Eastern Conference is simply awful, and it shouldn't take that much to be a top four team in the East. And I think that there is, you know, they have, should have as good a shot at being one of those teams as anyone.
The other team that's kind of broken out of the pack, I mean, we knew the Heat were going to be the Heat, but the other New York team, the Knicks, which you also follow for the paper, has been the team that broke out of the pack so far and kind of has been the biggest challenger to the Heat in the East. I think that this is the month we really learn a lot about the Knicks, because they've got to go without Raymond Felton after that finger injury, and they've got to put Amari Stoudemire back into the fold and find his place in the rotation. Are those really the challenges? Is the next month kind of a, where they really start to define themselves?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, the fact is they've already started to backslide. You know, they're, I think, 7-5 over their last 12 games as we speak. And during that time, they had about the 26th or 27th ranked defense in terms of defensive efficiency. So, you know, they're not a great defensive team that everybody thought that they would be and that they sort of looked like for a while in November. They do have some chemistry issues, and losing Ray Felton on top of that is going to exacerbate things. What made them really effective in November, you know, in addition to, of course, that just, you know, ridiculous barrage of three-point shooting, is that they finally became a team with great ball movement, which they never had last season. And having Kidd and Felton both in the backcourt certainly made that possible. And it rubbed off on everyone, and Carmelo Anthony has been knocked throughout his whole career for not being much of a ball mover. Got into the act and was moving the ball too. And what we're seeing lately is, I think, a little bit more stagnation, a little less flow. And again, the offense is good enough, but their defense has been so bad that, you know, the Knicks can't sustain what they had in November. So, yeah, tests are coming up. And frankly, one of the things that was the biggest concern going into the season was, you know, the jokes made about, you know, the old roster. They persevered through that in the first month, and everybody all of a sudden forgot about that, I think, as an issue. And people thought, well, those guys aren't supposed to be critical anyway. Well, it turns out a couple of them are really critical. Jason Kidd is extremely critical to this team, and he's one of your oldest guys. So you've got to be concerned, and especially with Felton out, that you don't let his minutes go too far. And Rasheed Wallace, with him out, I think that's part of the reason for the backsliding on the defense. And again, you're relying on a guy who's in his late 30s and who spent 2 years in retirement and just came back. No wonder he's getting hurt, and Camby's been mostly hurt. So, you know, if some of your most critical guys are the ones who are the oldest guys, now you do have an issue all season. And the deeper into the season you go, the more of a concern it becomes when you have older players and players that could become injured, be worn out by the schedule, by the back-to-backs, the four games and five nights. And Amari Stoudemire, yes, is still a major concern as well. He's obviously got to work his way back into basketball shape, get his rhythm back. As we all know, he and Carmelo Anthony have never really thrived together. Every stat in the world bears that out. So they have some challenges. They're starting to face their real adversity that, you know, that they didn't have to in the first 5 or 6 weeks of the season, and that should be expected. But you know, how they handle that will ultimately determine whether they really are one of the top teams in the East and a true challenger to Miami, or whether they're like everybody else, just another flawed second-tier team, all of them looking up at the Heat.
So you're saying that you can't judge what's going to happen in April and May based on what happened in November?
I was trying to say that even in November, but nobody wanted to listen, in New York. But, you know, hey, I know, who could blame them? I mean, you know, Knicks fans have been through hell for the last decade or so, and you know, I don't begrudge them having some fun while everybody was, while the Knicks were rolling through everybody and beating Miami twice by 20 points. But no, I thought those early returns were probably a bit skewed. And this is why the season's 82 games long and why it's so much fun to watch, because, you know, you just don't see what's coming next.
Yeah, exactly right. Well, thanks a lot for your time, Howard. And we'll have to have you back on soon.
Absolutely, Kurt. Anytime. Thanks.
All right, well, let's look ahead to the big game of Friday night. We have the Battle of Los Angeles between the Lakers and the Clippers, and the tables have turned a little bit this season, where the Clippers are actually the star-studded team who's piled up the wins. They recently had that huge winning streak. They've lost two straight since, but something tells me they have a little something in the tank waiting for the Lakers. Lakers haven't played in a couple days, which might help that so-called energy problem. that they claim to have had against, you know, a fairly woeful Sixers team. I mean, that loss was kind of inexcusable. But what are you seeing out of tonight's game? What do you expect between the Lakers and the Clippers?
I think when it comes to playing the Clippers, it really always comes down to ball control and not turning the ball over and controlling the tempo. If you cough the ball up, and they force more turnovers than any team in the league, yeah. If you turn the ball over and you let them get out in transition and Chris Paul's throwing lobs to Blake Griffin, it energizes them on both ends of the floor. They come back more fired up. Plus, those are the easy baskets that are just hard to make up. At the end of the day in the NBA, if you give a team a lot of easy buckets at the rim and don't challenge and contest stuff, it's hard to make those points up against a good team. And the Clippers are a good team, and if they get a bunch of easy points, they'll run the Lakers out of the building, and you know they want to run the Lakers out of the building. So it's going to be interesting to see if the Lakers can handle that pressure. You know, they haven't been smooth on offense at all, and they're going to be up against a kind of pressure defense. And, of course, the second part of this game tonight is this game could be close for the first quarter, and the Clippers bench could blow this thing open in the second quarter easily against that Lakers bench. Because if it comes down to Jamal Crawford and Jody Meeks, I'm going to lean with the Clippers and Crawford.
Yeah, you just might want to lean that way. I think you hit it exactly with the Clippers' defense, their defensive pressure, and you know, the Lakers have to limit their transition opportunities. I think the one thing the Lakers have going for them is that they do have Steve Nash running the point. You know he's going to play 38, 40 minutes tonight. So the turnover factor should be a little bit less with him in control. I'm always worried for the Lakers when Darius Morris has anything to say about the offense. Still don't really understand why D'Antoni keeps sticking with him. He said he wanted to develop him, and that's why he's giving him minutes. But he started a couple games and then been yanked after like 9 minutes and then never played the rest of the night. So I really don't understand what's going on there. That's the worrisome part, is if he gets those ball handling opportunities. But you know, with a couple of days to prepare for the Clippers, knowing how aggressive they are, how their guards get after it, pressure the perimeter, they do get a lot of steals, they do get a lot of transition opportunities. You would hope that D'Antoni would have a game plan in place that would feature either Steve Nash or Kobe Bryant initiating the offense on virtually every possession.
You would hope so. You would like to think that. The other part of that is, I think the other really interesting matchup is the front lines, because the Clippers' front line isn't as skilled as Dwight Howard and Pau Gasol. I mean, Blake Griffin and DeAndre Jordan, however, are wildly more athletic.
Yeah.
It makes for an interesting matchup. I think that's one of the things the Clippers have done well this season, is better utilize their athleticism on defense. Rather than having DeAndre Jordan kind of hang back and just block shots in the paint, they're having those guys chase people around, use that athleticism, chase people down, pressure on the all over the court a little bit. They show a lot more on screens. They try some trapping stuff that they didn't used to do. And with all of that, I think that that is a challenge for the Lakers' big men to take advantage of. They have the savvy. They have the guys who can do it. You can make a team pay for being too aggressive, but the Clippers have that athleticism where they're like, we can pressure and still recover because we're just that athletic right now.
Yeah, and speaking of athletic, the Lakers are going to need an athletic Dwight Howard tonight. I mean, there's no way that they can get by with him, you know, being at half speed. You know, hopefully, again, a couple days rest. Maybe he'll be a little bit more explosive. We've seen it in short spurts from him this season. We know he can do it. He's still not all the way back from his back surgery that he had in the offseason. They're going to need the athletic Dwight Howard if they're going to want to compete with those athletic bigs of the Clippers.
Agreed. And, you know, I'm beginning to wonder if Dwight Howard's rush to get back with the Lakers has hurt him. I wonder if he wanted to be back so bad for opening night and he would have been better off sitting out the first 3 weeks of the season and 4 weeks of the season, if that would have helped his cause.
No, I think that probably would have been a better way to go. But, you know, again, the Lakers are under a lot of pressure when you compile this much talent, and it's kind of a win now mentality, not just this season, but now as in right now. And, you know, speaking of that, do you think the Lakers are starting to run out of time a little bit? We're about 40% through the season. They still haven't been able to get over 500 and stay there. Are they starting to run out of time? I mean, they're going to have to start stringing together large chunks of wins fairly quickly just to get into the playoffs, much less, you know, get themselves a decent seed.
Right, and I've said this a few times now. I mean, they're 9 games back at the Clippers right now in the West. They're not catching the Clippers. Even if the Clippers come back to earth a little bit, you know, that they're not catching them, and that becomes a problem ultimately. You know, I think 6th seed is probably as good as it gets for the Lakers, even if they start to really string things together in a deep Western Conference, because, look, Oklahoma City's really good. San Antonio puts up great numbers in the regular season. The Clippers are going to be there. It's just going to be hard to climb up that ladder, and now you're talking about all your playoff series being road series, and that is a long, hard road if you're talking about making the finals. I think they've dug themselves a hole now that even if they bring it together, it's going to be hard to get out of by the playoffs.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think we see them missing the postseason altogether. I think, you know, they're going to be able to put together enough wins to get themselves in. But you're right. I mean, I think if you're expecting them to be higher, I think a fifth seed, you know, right around there is their ceiling, given the hole that they've dug. And, you know, again, that if you're a five seed, you're going to be playing the four seed, and that is not going to be any fun. You know, you're starting off with a very tough team right from the very first round.
Yeah, exactly. And on the road. And then you're going to have to go to somewhere like San Antonio. And then at the end of the day, Oklahoma City, still really good. And you're going to have to play them in the loudest building in the league.
Yeah. And then, you know, again, we're talking about San Antonio and Oklahoma City, who might just end up being flat out better anyway when it's all said and done.
Exactly.
All right. Well, that's all the time we have for this week. Make sure to leave us some comments. Let us know how we're doing. And Kurt, look forward to speaking with you next time.
Same here.